Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on March 11th, 2017. Following a 30-minute Shamatha Vipassana meditation, my Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Saddhamma Sutta, a sutta on false Dhammas. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So we have another new face this morning. Welcome, I'm John.
I'm Jerry.
Jerry, welcome to our Sangha. It's nice to have you here. Do you have a meditation practice? Okay, I'll talk more about what we do, and maybe if you want to stay after class for just a few minutes. Not that you've done anything wrong, but I'll give you a little bit more instruction. But welcome to our Sangha. I'm going to give a talk related to meditation and part of the broader framework that we teach here. So. First time here, and Charlie's new to it, might seem a little bit out of context, but it all relates back to the Four Noble Truths and what the Buddha taught throughout his career. It supports our meditation practice. So today's talk is on the Saddhamma Sutta. The Saddhamma Sutta answers a question about the need for additional rules of behavior within the Sangha as the Sangha developed. Even during the Buddha's time, there were adaptations, accommodations, and embellishments made to the Dhamma that led to unskillful behavior. I was going to skip a couple paragraphs, but I'll read it. The intense desire to alter the Dhamma to fit confused views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths has persisted until today. This has resulted in many contradictory Buddhist religions that together present a confusing dharma. I wrote an article last week and talked about it on Tuesday. This is kind of a continuation of that. I was going to speak Tuesday and today on the article called Modern Buddhism, A Thicket of Views, but I thought that this would be a little more skillful to have a separate talk on that and then this that relates directly to that. And what that article talks about is just the many, many different contradictory forms of modern Buddhism, and they all can't be right. If you follow one, you're going in one direction. If you follow another, there's a different purpose and focus in that, and most of them contradict what the Buddha teaches. So that doesn't mean that they're wrong or bad or not legitimate. They're just different, and that difference is important. And the other problem that has arisen is this modern push to create a one-size-fits-all Buddhism. In other words, to reconcile all the different teachings that are today into one cohesive Buddhist practice. And there's quite a few organizations that talk about that's what their purpose is. And what's almost always lost, and usually the first thing that's discarded, is the Buddhist teachings on the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path. Because it's so easy to fit these other more exciting so-called practices and make that a Buddhist practice rather than the simple and direct practice that the Buddha taught. And this sutta goes back 2,600 years, and it kind of addresses the same problem. So, excuse me. What has developed is at best ineffective in developing the stated purpose of the Buddha's teachings. Again, this is what the Buddha was teaching. The Buddha said that I teach the origination of suffering and the cessation of suffering, nothing more. And he said that consistently throughout 45 years. What is most interesting to note today is how far-reaching is the belief that the Buddhist teaching should be accommodated to fit ever-changing views. Often the justification for these accommodations is another misapplied teaching from the Buddha, the Buddha's words. Therefore, O monks, if you know the purpose of what I have said, excuse me, you should keep it in mind accordingly. But if you do not know the purpose of what I have said, you should question me about it, or else ask the other monks. So that one line, and this is similar to what's in the Kalama Sutta, people have taken that line where the Buddha says you should question me, meaning question me directly while he was still alive, and changed it to fit this idea that we can create an accommodated form of Buddhism by saying the Buddha said to question everything, meaning that whatever you don't like, question it and discard it if it doesn't fit. Of course, the Buddha wouldn't spend 45 years of his life teaching a very specific Dhamma practice and say, if you don't like it, forget about it, or pick and choose. Why would he spend all that time? And of course, he didn't do that. What he meant by questioning him is question him directly. If you have a question, there he is in front of you, ask him. Don't go off and try to compare it to some other teacher or practice and expect to get a consistent and useful answer. Question him directly. Of course, we can't do that anymore, can we? But what we have is the written record of the Buddha's teachings preserved in the Pali Canon. And that's what we can refer to when we have a question about the Dhamma. Or hopefully you have a teacher that knows everything there is to know about. Well, you got somebody you can ask a question to anyway. But the point is that, of course, the Buddha did not teach something that we can pick and choose and say, well, I like this part. I like the part about craving, but I don't care too much about dukkha. I like right view, but I don't care too much about right intention. If you want to develop the Buddhist teachings, you develop the Buddhist teachings. If you don't, you don't. And we're all free to do anything else. But the important thing is if we want to have the full effect of the Buddhist teachings, we have to integrate it fully. But that's not all that difficult. So, and again, another interesting part about this is that even during the Buddha's time, there was this push to accommodate the Buddha's teachings to fit views, which is really the heart of the matter, isn't it? Self-referential views. And invariably, what I've seen from many years being involved in this, as soon as we start trying to or take license with the Buddha's teachings and start to adapt it or accommodate it to fit my view, all I'm doing is reinforcing a self-referential view. And then I can develop a Buddhist practice, so-called, that allows me to continue those self-referential views and continue confusion, delusion, and suffering. Hence the name of Tuesday's article, The Thicket of Views. The Buddha even used that phrase, the thicket of views, when other people would come to him and ask him questions about this teacher said this and this teacher said that and you say this and I say this and what about that? And the Buddha would say, that's just the thicket of views. Meaning, let go of the views and apply this teaching. And then he would always say, you've heard me use that term, ehepasiko, meaning come and see for yourself. But how can we do that unless we actually practice the Buddhist teachings? So, to get into the sutta. The Buddha was in Savatthi in Jiva's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. A senior monk, Mahakasapa, went to the Buddha with a question. Why is it that there are more training rules now than before, yet fewer Sangha members developing full understanding? And the answer is kind of in that question. Kasapa, this is the direct result of what occurs when beings are degenerating and the true Dhamma begins to disappear. This would not occur when a counterfeit Dhamma has not arisen in the world, but will always occur when counterfeit Dhammas are revered. And that's a good word there too. I mean, everything obviously is translated from the Pali to the English, and the translator is the one that's picking and choosing the English word, but using that word revered, we've created all these different types of religions, and a religion is something that we revere, and we tend to worship parts of that religion. Even if it's a counterfeit teaching, we still tend to revere it. Why? Because we've now created an identity. I'm this type of Buddhist, I'm that type of Buddhist, this is the one true Buddhism. Exactly the same problem that the Buddha had during his time. The Buddha continues, just as there is no diminishing or disappearance of gold when there is no counterfeit gold, when counterfeit Dhamma is present, it diminishes the value of the true Dhamma and can completely obscure the Dhamma. In the same way, when there is no counterfeit Dhamma in the world, there will be no diminishing or disappearance of my teachings. Interestingly enough, the Buddha taught in northern India and southern Nepal in the beginning. The first place that Buddhism was established and then vanished was India. And for many, many, many years, there was really no Buddhist practice in India. It's really just coming back in the last 100 years. And because of this, they simply substituted other teachings, particularly the Hindu teachings, not really Hindu teachings, but the Vedas, which modern Hinduism is based on, that slowly overtook the population. And also there was an impetus from within the modern Buddhist Sangha that was no longer practicing the Buddhist teachings that wanted a more visionary, more esoteric, more mystical type of practice, and the Vedas are perfect for that. Again, I'm not putting it down, it's just what occurred. The Buddha continues, it is not the nature of the world to cause the true Dhamma to disappear. It is foolish people who arise within the Sangha. Within the Sangha. So the Buddha is not concerned here, even back then, of what's occurring outside the Sangha because he knows he has no control and really no influence there. It's within the Sangha that his concern is. And that's where right speech is so important within the Sangha, meaning honest speech about the Dhamma. When the Buddha talks about how we engage in right speech within a Sangha, he's talking about his Sangha there, but it's another reason why I'm kind of insistent that we keep our focus here, is that he said just that. When you're gathered together as a Sangha, you talk about the Dhamma. It's not, there's no value in getting into a debate about other teachings or, you know, talking about chariot races or anything else. Talk about the Dhamma when you're together as a Sangha. The true Dhamma disappears gradually from within, like a boat slowly sinking. The Buddha was predicting exactly what would happen over the years. There are five unskillful qualities that confuse people and lead to the disappearance of the true Dhamma. Those that live with disrespect for the true teachers, those with disrespect for the Dhamma, those that live with disrespect for the Sangha, those that live with disrespect for the Eightfold Path, those that live with disrespect for deepening concentration. Even that last line is interesting, isn't it? The Buddha taught a meditation practice primarily for deepening concentration so that we can support the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. But even then, there were meditation practices that weren't used for deepening meditation, but were used for all types of reasons, some helpful, but not part of the Buddha's teachings. These are the five unskillful qualities that confuse people and lead to the disappearance of the true Dhamma. My friends, there are five skillful qualities that develop stability and clear insight that will preserve the true Dhamma. Those that live with respect for true teachers. Those that live with respect for the Dhamma. Those that live with respect for the Sangha. Those that live with respect for the Eightfold Path, and those that live with respect for deepening concentration, the true meditation practice. These are the five skillful qualities that develop stability and clear insight that will preserve the true Dhamma. Upon hearing the Buddha's words, Mahakasapa and those assembled were delighted. So, that's the end of the sutta. There's more to the article if you want to read it. The Buddha is pointing out here, too, how simple it is to maintain his teachings, isn't he? There's five things to consider. It's not a lot. And really, all that he's saying is to practice fidelity to his teachings and to the teachers that have actually studied the Buddha's teachings. In other words, and this happens often, in any subject, if you're learning from a teacher, if you want to go to school to learn pre-med, but you end up in a class of teaching how to change the oil in your car, that teacher might know everything there is to know about mechanics, but he can't teach you anything about pre-med, can he? Or any other subject. A teacher has to study the subject that they're teaching if they're going to teach it. And you can't teach the Buddha's teachings unless you actually study it. You don't get it from listening in general to what the practice is. You have to actually study it. The whole notion, and I want to talk about this when we go around the room. The last we concluded our Dhamma study last week on the Ratana Sutta, and I'd like to hear how you what your understanding of that is in relation to the Four Noble Truths. But what the Buddha taught those people in Visali who were devastated by disease and natural disaster was once you take care of your physical needs, you take to the Dhamma, take refuge in the Dhamma. What does that mean? It means you take refuge in that a human being actually did this, what we're talking about, and awakened, gained full human maturity. He left his teaching, the Dhamma, to take refuge in, meaning that we can actually use that Dhamma as a true refuge. But we can't use the Dhamma as a true refuge if we substitute something else for it. And then to take refuge in a well-focused Sangha. You know, I know I've said this often here. When Ananda asked the Buddha, what's the most important part of what you're teaching, Ananda's expecting this great, grand, magical, mystical answer. And the Buddha said, the Sangha is the most important thing, meaning that we can't do it alone. We need a well-focused Sangha. We need an authentic Sangha that is actually focused on the Buddha's teachings. Again, if you want to learn something else, that's fine. If you want to be a Tibetan Buddhist or a Roman Catholic or you know, pick anything, or just a New Age philosopher, study that. Fine, but if you want to learn and study and develop what the Buddha taught, you have to actually teach it. But that the confusing things that have arisen make it very, very difficult. It took me years and years and years of intense practice to finally find what the Buddha actually taught. And it was at that point that everything changed for me. So that's the talk. That's the teaching today. So, let's go around the room. Any questions on this? But I'd also like to hear how you what you learned about the Ratana Sutta in relation to the Four Noble Truths. And I know you weren't here last week, but...
I was not here last week.
Good to see you, Laura.
It's good to be here. Are you starting with me?
Yes. I'd like to put you on the spot since you haven't been here.
Well, I have a deep gratitude for the Sangha. I was thinking about that this morning. And for you, just for being here. Mm-hmm. And I knowing everyone's here when I can't make it. There's something reassuring in that.
I agree.
So I wasn't here for the Sutta talk, and I did not read up on it. Was that the hindrances?
No, the Ratana Sutta, where the Buddha teaches what it means to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha.
Perfect. I'm in a constant process of kind of neglecting and then re-realizing the importance of taking refuge in the Dhamma and the Sangha and the Buddha, of course, because that's where these teachings came from.
Okay.
So, I have direct experience of an increased suffering in my life when I kind of neglect to pay attention to or remember the Four Noble Truths or remember my meditation practice. And I have a direct experience of the relief of the suffering when I return to that. So, yeah, it's pretty simple and straightforward in my life, the correlation of that. And, lately I've just been kind of amazed at how complicated this not-self of mine wants to make things. There's such a urge to complicate things. And just even in meditation, the amount of thoughts that go through my mind and pull me in different directions and want to entertain me when away from just paying attention to my breath. Lighthearted perspective on it right now, but I don't always. Sometimes I'm a little more frustrated by that, but it's just relentless. It's this relentless not self trying to come in and interrupt a knowing insight that I've had, and I find that really frustrating sometimes.
Yeah,
and at times discouraging. So. But taking refuge in the Sangha, knowing that you're here when I can't make it due to life circumstances is helpful. So, thank you.
Thank you for all that you said. And you said a lot. It's so important to recognize, that's what ehipasika means, that when you're not deeply engaged in the practice, there seems to be more suffering in our own life, more disappointment, more... unsatisfying experiences. That's a measure of concentration, simply to be able to see that. And then that the complication of eye-making is really what I was talking about here and in Tuesday's article about the thicket of views. All of that, these adaptations and accommodations that have arisen can all be seen as just another subtle form of eye making. In other words, I need to make it something else that fits my view, rather than recognizing that it's my view that's causing the difficulty in the first place. And that gets everything very complicated. And again, the problem of craving and clinging. I want something to be different than it is. I find a way that makes it different and more acceptable, and I cling to it. And now I have a different identity. And that becomes that thing that keeps coming up, that frustration because of conditioned thinking. which again is exactly and precisely why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, to give us a framework for recognizing our self-referential conditioned thinking. And you described that beautifully, so thank you for being here this morning. Mark, good to see you. How are you?
Good to be here. I wasn't here for the talk last week either, so...
it's online.
So I'm glad I went second and that I could think about it a little bit.
Sorry, Laura.
Sorry. I sat here for a reason.
So thank you. What I was thinking about, though, was that, I feel outside of the Sangha, I feel surrounded in life by kind of what feels like a lot of challenges to the practice. So I guess what I mean by that is I interact with people constantly throughout the day, and I constantly see the distraction, right, that comes up. And I feel it, and sometimes there almost feels like there's, when you're surrounded by that all around you, it feels like there's a tendency to, or potential to question whether you're doing it wrong. So I take refuge in the Sangha, the Buddha, and the Dhamma in the fact that, and it took me a little while to get there, but to kind of have... I'll use the word faith, that what I'm doing isn't wrong, that it's actually right. And sometimes that can feel overwhelming because of the sheer number of interactions that you have that are counter to it. Yeah. But I think, kind of like what Laura said, when I'm not focused on the Dhamma, I feel it, and I feel that stress in my life start to come up more. And then when I am well focused, that quiets quite a bit. And I feel like I can see things that are happening around me a little bit more clearly. So I guess that's how I tie it back to the refuge.
Yeah, and you see the benefits of it there. The Buddha could nearly as accurately said in describing the First Noble Truth that there is distraction as opposed to dukkha, because it really is almost one and the same thing. Suffering requires ongoing suffering, or ongoing disappointing experiences require constant distraction, which is the opposite of a well-concentrated mind. And it's the well-concentrated mind that sees things, and an awakened well-concentrated mind that sees things always from right view, meaning understanding that that constant interaction with the outside world is always going to be prone to dukkha. It's the nature of the world. We tend to then start judging ourselves, like I'm doing something wrong because I feel like I'm caught up in the dukkha, when it's just a recognition that this is, here I am. The Buddha left the most incredibly luxurious life because he was a prince in his father's kingdom, because he saw the distractions inherent in that life. And he went and lived in the forest so he could develop his understanding. He needed peace and quiet. I always say, and I contend, that it's much easier to develop awakening as a monk or a nun, removed from the world, than to actually have to bring our practice into the world and have those ongoing distractions. That doesn't mean that it can't be done. There's many stories. I mentioned Anatha Pandika's monastery. Anatha Pandika was a very busy and very successful businessman who took to the Buddha's teachings, continued his business, continued his worldly affairs, and awakened. And there's many, many stories of people like that. So we can do it, but it ain't easy. We need that refuge at least twice a day on our cushions, just to take that refuge, and give ourselves that refuge from the world for a few minutes twice a day, hopefully.
I think that's one of the main things that, for me right now with work, I see that the way that people approach maybe problems or what they perceive to be problems. And for a long time, I felt like the way that that was done, the way that people approach things, was the only right way to do it. Because that seems like the environment you're in, that's what everyone's doing.
Yeah.
And it feels very much like you're swimming upstream to say, I don't think that's right, and I think that maybe we should do it this way. And that might take a little bit longer, and we might have to do it a little bit more methodically instead of go, 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 rush, rush, rush. But the practice has helped me see that maybe the way that I'm looking at it, right or wrong, it's different, right? And it can be, that doesn't make it wrong. It just makes it different.
It's different.
And sometimes if you can pursue that difference, if you're given the ability to pursue that difference in more of a well-concentrated way, the outcome seems to be much better. So I guess I'm at an impasse where it's having that security of the Dhamma and understanding that maybe what I'm seeing or what I'm thinking isn't wrong, even though it's counter to all the things around me.
Yeah.
And then you have a choice to make. Do you continue to try to swim upstream, or do you maybe go look for a stream where you can swim in the right direction?
No, it is. It's difficult at times going against the stream, and that kind of relates to that idea of a stream enterer too. The Buddha was the biggest radical of his time, and I think for all time. He went against everything with this simple and direct path. And it's, I could say it still goes against most of modern thinking. And it's just different. It doesn't mean that everybody else is wrong, but if you want to develop what the Buddha's stated purpose is, a recognition and a profound understanding of the nature of disappointment and suffering, and a way to bring cessation to our individual contributions, this is the way. That's all the only thing he ever taught. And understanding the difference, the discreteness of it, is so important, rather than this, and again, it goes back 2,600 years, probably before that, this thing that we need to make everything have one kind of acceptable view, and this is how it's looked at. Well, too much is lost that way. But it's hard. It's hard to be the only one, but it works. Thank you, Mark. Jen, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
How are you?
Mark thought I still had three more people to go. It's good, though, because what Mark said really hit home for me as well. And it relates to also taking refuge. And also some of the stuff you said about revering, thinking about how revering just generally, is a kind of clinging, and it is a distraction that will, no matter what you're revering, whether it's a religious teaching or if it's your boss, if you are revering that, now you've identified yourself as something, and you've attached yourself to something, and now it becomes about that instead of about what is skillful or what is happening. I do relate to what Mark was saying about feeling like you're swimming upstream, thinking I have right view in a situation at work, and then getting attached to that right view, and also needing to make everybody else see right view, and I'm starting to see how that is also clinging. If that makes any sense.
Does. That's exactly it.
This time of year generally is stressful, but there's some other things that are going on at my job I'm feeling squeezed by what I know is right versus what the people around me feel like is right. This practice has been really just It's like the whole, I mean, I don't even, I would not be able to be getting through it without this practice, because it's tense and it's frustrating and it's, you know, there's fear. I'm afraid. I'm angry. And other people around me are as well. And that's incredibly distracting and difficult. It's difficult to navigate and be skillful in that atmosphere. But I feel like I'm doing it. And, you know, I'm seeing myself in action, and I'm seeing a lot of distraction for myself. But then I have moments where, you know, I'm in my head and I'm angry and I'm frustrated and, oh, you know, this situation needs to be sorted out and I need to talk to this person, this person, this person. And then I start to teach and I'm just in it. And I'm right back into this moment. And that is a refuge, I feel.
Yeah.
Because when that happens and I move into that space of being really in, you know, engaged in what's happening now, it reminds me of the Eightfold Path. And it reminds me of, you know, this moment is what I'm doing, and I need to be doing what is in front of me, and all of the rest of that. You know, and that's a refuge. Just can fall away.
Yeah.
I've been listening to meditation has been difficult. This meditation today, I did not think about anything other than how I was going to have conversations with administrators over the next week.
Yeah.
Except for when you said, you know, come back to your breath. Then I was thinking, thought about my breath for 3 seconds, and then but you know, that's just what's happening.
Yeah.
And but the thing that really pulls me back into the now is just, I mean, I just listen to talks. It's the only thing that I can, and listening to you talk now, that then I was, you know, I'm in it. So there's that it's nice to have that, knowing that there is something that will bring me back into the moment. Sometimes, you know, if I'm having a quiet moment, if it's not meditation, it's nice to know that there's other things.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Thank you. Again, you're describing exactly how to develop the framework, and you recognize when you're might be in wrong. You recognize that you were in wrong view when you expect other people to be in right view.
Yeah.
that's craving and clinging,
right.
Right there. And you know, and again, it's a very common thing to occur. I'm doing this. Everybody else should be doing this. I have such a calm and peaceful mind. Why doesn't everybody else? What's the matter with them? Thank you, Jen. Tommy, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good morning, John. Good morning. I'm well. I'm, you know, I really am trying to evolve. I've been taught that prayer and meditation brings one closer to God and to a better state of being. Certainly, you know, the dealing with either suffering or the rat's mind that's monkey mind that's in my head. Whatever tools and whatever growth I can enlist in that pursuit is, you know, why I'm here. But I always enjoy trying to glean, you know, from your teachings and from the teachings of Buddha. And just, you know, I need as much help as I can get. So I'm out there in the garden of life trying to pick the right fruits. And I just know that it's a process that is not natural to me. That's for darn sure. So I know that it's taken a long time to sort of develop or redevelop a physically healthful way of life. which is good, and I think I'm making some good, you know, established progress. But now I'm trying to enlist the same, you know, facilities for my spirit and for my mind. Mm. So that's, I always enjoy that, and trying to find the time and the consistency to do it as a challenge for me. So happy to be here.
I'm glad you're here, and that challenge is very, very common. Everybody talks about it. Charlie and Jerry, I'll get to you at the end. Mm-hmm. Eva, how are you?
I'm well, John.
It's good to see you.
Here with everyone. What I was thinking about is that we're all creatures of habit. I know that I am, and that I often rely on that, because then I don't have to really think of anything or be aware of what I'm doing. And the eye making, you know, it's a part of our life. You know, if I go in and I introduce myself, I'm Eva, and then my mind then goes to all the things that I think Eva is.
Yeah.
And then you realize that what other people think Eva is has to do with things that I may not think have anything to do with Eva. And so it's a lot of... so then habit is an easy thing to go back to, because then I don't have to be other than what I've been. Mm-hmm. And it's always good to know that the Buddha and the... Don't tell me. The Buddha and the... And the Sangha and the... What's the other one?
Dhamma.
Are there as guideposts, to remind me that I don't have to stick to that, to those habits, and that it's encouraging to know that others are experiencing things that, you know, wow, I never thought of it that way, or, you know, this is a whole other idea that I hadn't looked at, and really expands on where I, the path that I want to take, and it is a wonderful foundation to try to be a part of.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha is sometimes called taking refuge in the three jewels. And when you look at it that way, it would be silly to take a diamond and paint it blue because you like sapphires, wouldn't it? We do the same. It often happens to the Dhamma. We like it to be a little bit different. We like to take this perfect jewel and maybe make it into something that it's not by putting the coating of our own views onto it. And that's the problem. It is, and it really is the heart of the problem. The Buddha taught this so we can recognize and abandon all self-referential views. Why? So we can develop a calm and peaceful mind. It's all that the Dhamma is about. But it's really, it's what everyone wants. Everybody wants to develop that place of a calm and peaceful mind where happiness prevails, but we don't understand how to get it. It's focused on the outside rather than the inside. Becky, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you, John. Great to be here. Well, since I started coming to the Sangha, I am calmer. And my practice revolves around, I'm retired, so I don't have a lot of people on the outside that are causing me, that I have to deal with, or that I have to, you know, learn how to be in right view with a lot of different people. So really, my practice has been to let go, to work toward letting go of the wrong views that I do to myself to make me have dukkha. And it's been, excuse me, really the Sangha and the meditation have really helped with that. I mean, not that I can do it, but I have a method that I can practice that I have learned that it works. It works for me.
Yeah.
Because it has worked at certain instances. But you really have to keep. You have to keep practicing. And as soon as I go for, like, this week, I was away at a friend's house for 2-3 days of this week visiting. So I didn't meditate while I was there, which I could have. There were times when I could have. Mm-hmm. But since I was in a different place, it was a different routine, I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I just realized that you have to have that practice.
Yes.
At least once a day for me. I hardly do meditation twice a day. I usually am once a day. And that's okay. I'm not pushing myself. That's okay. But it's when I was with my friends, who I have known for my whole life. Well, not my whole life, but since Jen was in my stomach.
Jen's 23 years.
25 years ago.
The woman is, like I said, a very good friend. And she has, you know, a wonderful family. She has children that are married. She has several grandchildren. And she's so stressed. And I thought to myself, is it right view? I just felt like I wanted to do something for her. Is it right view to, you know, want to sort of, you know, talk her into a sangha? Mm-hmm. And then I thought, no, that's probably not right view to try to do that. But she takes, you know, tranquilizers. And if she doesn't take one, you can tell that she hasn't taken it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, I just feel sorry that she's let herself get really to that place. Mm-hmm. And thankful that I have this sangha, because I was going there. I feel like I'm so much calmer and so much more able to realize that all of this stuff that I'm afraid of and that I'm worried about isn't happening now. It's not happening now. You know? So look at the life you're living.
Yep.
It's one day at a time. And so that's my refuge.
Yes. that's beautiful. Thank you.
And I also have one question that has a more intellectual question. The teachings of the Buddha are available for us to look at that came, like you said, 2,600 years ago, that he wrote down in his own hand, from himself. And they've been changed, as you say, that a lot of people have change them in some way. Do those changes, are they, is it a an exercise in trying to interpret what he meant? Or is what he meant and what he said really clear, and they're just wanting to make it easier or make it more complicated or make it, you know, lovelier or some, you know what I mean? Are they trying to interpret it because it's not clear, or are they trying to change it in some way from the clear thing that it is?
Yes.
That is very clear.
Whenever I get it,
like it's very clear the way you're telling us. But I mean, I just, in every other religion, the writings that sort of are the basis of what's happening are not clear, and so it's these people trying to interpret them and tell them, you know.
Okay, no, it's such an important. Whenever I get an intellectual question, I try to find an intellectual to answer it. So, but I'll do my best. Just to go back to what you said about the Buddha wrote down everything. The Buddha didn't write anything down. There was writing during the time of the Buddha. In fact, you know, before that, there was writing. The Greeks were writing, and some other civilizations. But the common belief, and it's reasonable when you really look at it, was that a oral tradition was much more accurate in preserving a certain teachings than writing something down. If you think about the act of writing, it's often writing becomes more interpretive than actually repeating something that you heard.
Okay.
So the Pali Canon wasn't put in written form until about 250 years after the Buddha's passing, and that's the age is debatable, but it was a while. But they had this oral tradition, and because the monks and the nuns had such a well-concentrated mind, they also had very good memories. And in particular, Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and his second, meaning he was with the Buddha every day for every teaching, for the last 25 years of his life and most of the previous 20 years, and he had a word-perfect memory. A month after the Buddha's passing, they had what was called the First Buddhist Council. And 500 of the senior monks who were all awakened gathered together for the sole purpose of recounting the Buddhist teachings and then preserving it in this oral tradition. So this council started. It was Ananda and I never can think of the other gentleman's name. The other gentleman was... It was his responsibility to mostly recite what he remembered of the Vinaya, meaning the monastic rules, so that they could be preserved. And Ananda would recite the suttas, so that they would be checked. In other words, you got 500 awakened beings listening to these teachings that they all heard, and they were checking Ananda's accuracy. So when you read the Pali Canon, it'll often start a sutta saying, "Thus have I heard." That's where you know that this is actually the Ananda's words, because he's sitting there in front of the council. He says, "This is what I heard," and usually they'll get into a description of where they were. We were in Savatthi at Jita's Grove. They'll discuss. Ananda will say, "Such and such was here," or "I was talking to the Vasalis," or "The Buddha was talking to the Vasalis," or "The Buddha was talking to Mahakasapa," and then he'll recount what he said. And almost all the suttas start that way. Some of them don't, and I won't get into the whole history of it. And as these 500 monks and nuns were listening, actually, I don't think there were any nuns in the first council, unfortunately, they would say, "Yes, this is how we heard it. Okay, this is good. This is something that we did." And then a small group of them would be responsible for continuing to recite those teachings. And there was different pockets of these groups that were responsible for maintaining the oral tradition by reciting it. And that's why the Pali Canon is so repetitive. And that was the beginning, actually, getting a little bit off the subject, that was the beginning of Buddhist chant. It wasn't because chanting is somehow magical or mystical or can bring us something. The repetitiveness of chant was important to just maintain the authenticity. And so in each subsequent council, there's been seven more. The last two really weren't based on maintaining authenticity, but the ones up till that were held in mostly the same way. Senior monks and nuns now would recite what they understood. It would be checked for accuracy going all the way back to the Buddha's time. Yes, that's how we heard it. That's how we remember it. That's how we're practicing it. And eventually that came to be written down. So that's how the Pali Canon came to be. Now, to answer your question about the interpretation, that's exactly what's happened. And there's always been this desire. If you think about interpretation from a conditioned point of view, another word for conditioned thinking is confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. We're biased towards seeing things in a way that confirms the view that we have, no matter how wrong or misapplied that teaching might be. That's the problem with conditioned thinking. And it's exactly the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. When the Buddha awakened, he sat for another couple of weeks trying to figure out, how can I teach this in a way that people will be able to use it and they won't alter it or adulterate it in any way? And there's the Eightfold Path. So if we develop the Eightfold Path, use it for the framework of our practice and ultimately how we live our life, then we're living in something that's authentic to the Buddha's teaching. When we discard that or adapt it in any way, we're adapting the key teachings of an awakened human being. And that's the problem, is that interpretation, wanting it to fit other views. Again, it's not right or wrong, it's simply what happens. Even within the Buddhist Sangha, even within Buddhism today, dukkha occurs. You know? Again, going back to what Mark said, another word for dukkha can be distraction, you know, or an unsatisfactory experience. We want to make something other than what it is. So, great question. Thank you for asking it. Debbie, how are you this morning? It's good to see you. You look cold. I should. I turned the heat off. I probably should have turned it back on.
Cold out there.
Yeah.
I'm good. I just kind of started rereading the book now that I finally got through the whole thing. You know, and it's doubtful, you know, to start reading it again.
Yeah.
I want to just try to really understand it. So, because that's the Dhamma. And yeah, it's always good for me to come here, kind of as a refresher to, you know, just for awareness.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot to say today, but I'm doing okay.
Good. I'm glad you're here, and that's exactly it. It is a lot of repetition, you know. Quite a few students online, even, that took the course, take it again. You know, if they integrate it for a couple months, come back to it. There is a lot there. It took me, to me, dependent origination is the clearest teaching. There's no ambiguity to it. But for the first 600 times I looked at it, it made no sense to me at all. You know, and now I can't understand how anybody could misunderstand it, except I misunderstood it for many years. It's really, as we deepen our understanding and broaden the framework of our understanding, then we're able to apply things and see how they fit. But that's just how it is. So, glad you're here. Lorna, good to see you.
Mm-hmm. Good to be here. Well, I was at dinner class on Tuesday. I'm here again today. And the broad spectrum of the topic is the false Dharma. I must hold my hand up and say I think that's how I think too, because I find that the true teachings of the Dharma from the Buddha are so contrary to how we do things. We do tend to, our imaginations tend to go down another path, a similar path that we can understand. And I think that's how I think about the Dharma in kind of like a regular way. That's often, when I really think about my thinking, I can identify to that. The question is it really a false Dharma, or are we really trying to work out the Dharma? I mean, it's not intentionally, and I don't think I'm going down a false Dharma path.
No.
But your imagination does. It's so difficult to look at the teachings of the Buddha so directly that you almost can't do it. It's like meditation. I mean, you just sit here and think about your breath. How can that? Is that difficult? You know.
Yeah, but it is, isn't it?
Yeah. But it is. Yeah. It's just difficult. And to keep your mind on one topic and keep... So I've just been recognizing in my own practice that I'm quite capable of going off on the wrong track with my thinking. So I must ask you to be a strong man at the helm and don't be swayed. I mean, you're the captain of the ship, sort of thing. So don't you get swayed, otherwise we're all in big trouble. Because I know I am quite capable of thinking about the Dharma in another way, other than truly the message that Buddha was trying to get across. And that is conditioned thinking, and it's eye making, and all those stuff, all that stuff we love to get into. That's the root of it. That's the root of why we find it hard to look at what the Buddha is saying. So I need you to be strong and forthright.
I'll do my best. I'll do my best. honestly, it's been difficult at times. Not so much now, but when I first started, and even maybe the first couple of years, a lot of people came here that wanted different experiences. They even talked about, why don't we play Pema Chodron tapes, or why don't we smudge the room first, or why don't we do this, or why don't we do that? That's all fine, but it's just not part of the Buddha's practice. So I remember saying to one gentleman who stopped coming after I said it, is I'd just like to have one place, maybe in the whole world, I don't think so, but where just the Buddhist teachings are presented. You know, why can't we have that? That's the only thing that I'm interested in. So there's probably no, you don't probably have to be worried about me changing it too much.
I don't think
so. Plus, it's the only thing I know.
Thank you for swimming up.
Well, you're welcome, but thank you all for your steadfastness. It really, I know you hear me say this a lot, it really is remarkable what has developed here in Frenchtown. I've been around this game a long time, and I've never seen it develop this way. And again, I'm not saying this is completely unique, but it is very uncommon in modern Buddhism to not have a sangha that does not get into everything that's presented as Buddhism. You know, and that's part of what you were talking about. It'd be I don't know, easy to do. There, we might have 30 or 40 people in this room. It would be more inclusive. It would be that all-in-one kind of Buddhism. But it doesn't. For me, it doesn't work. I'm just so fortunate that there's a group that believes in what the Buddha taught and not something else. So thank you for saying it. Thank you all. Now, to our newcomers. Charlie, how was your meditation, and do you have any questions about what we've talked about so far?
Well, my meditation was... it was intermittent, but the sum result is definitely one of feeling that there's something very close by always, but is totally forgotten, which is anchoring oneself in presence and, you know, through the breath, or just actually taking the attention and intending it through presence and just breathing. Simplifying, that it's just so close by, but that I'll go weeks and weeks and weeks in suffering, arguing, planning, despairing, whatever, you know,
yeah.
And never stopping to actually just go there, like go everywhere else outside,
yeah.
Except inside. And then when I feel that, it's like I've stepped into, I feel like I'm meeting myself. The first time in a long time. I'm like, oh, that's right. That's what, it's like you walk around in a dream and it's just kind of fuzzy. And I think that that's my my condition, and it's just unalterable. You can't do anything about it. You feel sort of wrong, but you can't really change it. But then you meditate, and you're like, well, actually, there is a way to connect to something that is more real.
Yeah.
So that's always, it's always surprising. But it's not surprising to me, actually, that we don't do it, because I also see how, you know, easy it is to just, it's, I guess it's like vanity, you know, wanting to do things your way because you think that you are special and an authority on it.
Yeah.
And then until things start going like really wrong, you're like, well, I thought I was doing everything that I should be doing. So, yeah, with one day at a time, I mean, I got, feel compelled to come to mindful things helping with mindfulness because, you know, whenever you don't, or set it, maybe, I don't know, maybe it is even Buddhist, that if whenever you fall short of your goal, examine your own actions, not, whereas I find, I'm telling another person, like, that, like, if you're not getting the result with me that you want, maybe you need to see me better or hear me better or do things differently. And then it's like, it takes a really long time. I feel like the light to go on, like, oh, wait, I'm not getting the results I want. Yeah. I'm telling the other person that you think. And so it's like, that's crazy.
You have a great perspective on the Dhamma. That's craving and clinging, you know? And that what you said about feeling like there's nothing there, the Buddha described the view of not-self, this thing born of self-referential views, as like an illusion. Notice he didn't say it is an illusion. He said it's like an illusion. There's nothing really there, except we try to make this conglomeration of views a permanent self, and there is the problem. That's what you're describing. So that the little bit of concentration that you develop in meditation initially gives you that perspective to start separating what's really occurring here and what's most meaningful and what should I be mindful of and what should I let go of. So you got a good start in that. I'm going to talk a little bit about establishing and maintaining a practice after I talk to Jerry, but I'm glad you're here and I'm glad you joined us today. Jerry, what do you think? How's your meditation this morning?
Good. A lot of positive as far as peace goes, and seeing a lot how a lot of times my mind is of course my worst enemy, and I relate to the I see something I describe as the domino effect. I am. Never seem to just like relax and just calm down when things go and just focus on the here and now. I'm trying to learn how to just focus on the here and now. And because I live in the past a lot. I think about like past things I've done or wish or regret or wish I should have done or a missed opportunity and then or something like that. And so. I'm learning to let that go, and then every day, every other day, I always see something out there in the world, and I'm like, oh, I have to do that. If I don't do that, I'm missing out. Well, I gotta go see this, or I gotta see that show, or I gotta see that concert, or I gotta go see that band. I gotta go see this Broadway play. Okay, so I do that stuff. I do it, and I do it, and then I enjoy it. But then I always like for somehow I have a bad habit of sometimes focusing on the negative or something. It's foolish. Well, I should have done this, or I should have done this, or I should have done something else.
There is dukkha.
And
well,
you did this. You did all. You did this. You did this. And you did that. You ought to be grateful. You ought to be thankful. So I'm seeing that. I need to just say, start being more thankful and start being more grateful and stop worrying about. Okay, maybe you missed something, or maybe you didn't do this, or maybe you didn't do that, or. let go. And just quit trying to chase everything out there in the world, because it's always going to be out there. Can't do it. And then I'm working on trying to stop doing something like what I call self-medicating. I get in a rut, or I feel kind of like, I don't know. I can't describe it, out of it. So I'll self-medicate by with food, or alcohol or something like that. In moderation, of course. But or spending time on YouTube and watching stuff on YouTube and all this. And then because of this negative domino effect, I always put these dominoes up there, and you're looking at all the negative stuff. Boom, 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 as they fall down. You say, you got 90% of those dominoes are positive. Good stuff. Boom, boom, boom. And every little negative thing is just a lesson that you're going to learn. It's going to, if it doesn't kill you, it's going to make you stronger. And then I realize that because I actually do this to myself, I actually find myself, and I don't even realize it unconsciously, I kick myself, I beat myself up. And I don't even realize it, but it actually affects, it pours into my relationships with my family and my business and the world around me. And I don't even realize it. And then I realized, I'm responsible for my own inner peace and happiness. Not how much, whatever, not how much material things I gain, or how much money I might have or don't have, or it's more or less, not how many people I've helped or kind to or generous to, which I try to do more often.
Well, so Jerry, what you're describing is dukkha, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just it. And so I got to say one thing. YouTube can be quite a distraction, but I'm on YouTube too, so there's some good there's some good aspects of that. You really described dukkha perfectly. And so this practice that you hopefully you'll continue is designed to recognize our contributions to that and bring it to cessation, to develop a well-concentrated mind so we don't do that. Hang around just a few minutes after. We're going to be finished in just a second. I know, Ed, we're going to be done in just a few minutes, so hang on. when you're beginning to a meditation practice, start with very short periods of meditation, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. And if you can do that twice a day, around 12 hours apart, you'll start to establish a meditation practice. To maintain that practice, there's more to it. There's the Eightfold Path that supports a meditation practice, and meditation supports the rest of the path. But to be part of a Sangha, and I hope you come back and join us again. There's a yellow booklet out there. Please take it. It describes this meditation method in the broader framework. There's a recording of Shamatha Vipassana meditation on my website that you can download and listen to help guide your practice. But I hope you both come back and join us again. Let's finish with metta like we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta, as soon as I can find it. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.